Shrink Wrap Radio number 430, Recent Findings on the Treatment of Insomnia with Dr. Barry Krakow.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My return guest today is Dr. Barry Krakow, and we'll be discussing the results of a large study he and his team conducted on insomnia and sleep apnea. Barry Krakow is a board-certified internist and sleep disorder specialist who has studied and practiced for 30 years in the fields of internal medicine, emergency medicine, addiction medicine, and sleep medicine. Currently, he is medical director of two sleep facilities in Albuquerque, New Mexico. For more information on Dr. Krakow's background, please consult our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Barry Krakow, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me, David.
Well, we last spoke back in October of 2010, and it seems just like yesterday, and that was on Shrink Wrap Radio number 248, in which we discussed your book, Sound Sleep, Sound Mind. And I'm glad to have you back on the show to discuss your latest research on insomnia.
Yeah, I'll be happy to discuss that with you. It's quite interesting material.
Well, you know, I usually don't have too much trouble sleeping through the night. But I don't know if it's the power of suggestion or what, but last night I had terrible insomnia. So,
I'll take the blame.
I guess I was so excited about this interview. That's what I have to assume, that it was just jamming up my circuits.
Well, that is an interesting point about insomnia. You know, a lot of people think it's just the negative emotions, quote unquote negative, that cause us to have insomnia. But, you know, enthusiasm, excitement, anticipation, you know, just getting just too revved up for something in the future that's going to be positive, you know, also can produce insomnia.
Yeah, well, that's a good spin for me to put on it now. Whenever I have insomnia, I'll just maybe make that assumption. Now, I believe you recently conducted a study with 1,200 chronic insomnia patients. What were the main findings? Kind of walk us through it.
Sure. I'll just give you the overview, and then we can go into whatever depth you would like.
Okay.
The overview is that we have been doing this research for almost 20 years, noticing that people who use sleeping pills, while it would seem like that's saying their insomnia is, you know, really bad and very severe, and they can only, you know, use pills, what we've been learning over and over again, and we've actually published several studies in this realm, is that the use of the sleeping pill seems to correlate with the idea that the patient's physiology of sleep is really messed up. And so on the one hand, the patient is right. The patient is saying, gosh, I wish there was a pill that would make my sleep better. Well, now we understand more about why the patient is right, and that is, most of these patients who have regular use of sleeping pills really have sleep-disordered breathing, sleep apnea, upper airway resistance syndrome. In other words, during the night, they don't breathe normally, and that breathing then leads to the brain recognizing there's a problem breathing, and then you end up with what's called sleep fragmentation. So that sleep fragmentation is, in effect, insomnia. It could cause you to have trouble falling asleep, trouble staying asleep, you know, early in the morning, and breathing events will do that. So this study that we did looked at 1,200, you know, plus insomniacs, and the most interesting kernel from it is that 900 of these people were regular users of a sleeping pill. And every single, one of them was failing the sleeping pill. The pill was not working for them. And of that 900, it's approximately, 85 to 90% of them had this sleep breathing problem that was actually probably playing a very big role in their insomnia.
Wow. And I believe in the article and the video that I saw, and I should mention that you have an excellent video on YouTube describing this whole study, and I will put a link to that in our show notes so listeners can find it and learn from it as I did. There you reported that 91% had sleep apnea, but they didn't recognize it as a breathing difficulty.
Right. Even though people will report things like I snore, or my wife says that sometimes I choke in my sleep, whatever the symptoms are, even if the person had awareness of that, they do not connect it to insomnia. So that's another big deal in terms of what we found in the study, that people are not saying when they walk into the doctor's office, doc, I snore and I think this is causing my insomnia, so can I get a sleep study? They're saying, I snore, but that's not why I came here. I came here for somebody to give me a pill or whatever to treat my insomnia. So that's a very important, gap in the knowledge between the primary care doctors, between the patients, and even between the patients and the sleep doctors. And this is why we were very fortunate to get our paper published in the Mayo Clinic Proceedings, which is a very prestigious journal. And we knew that it might then reach out more to primary care doctors who are a little bit too quick on the draw in prescribing sleeping pills for these patients when many of them really need a sleep study.
And would this in part be our propensity to look for a silver bullet in the form of a pill, that's kind of the first place that most of us go to?
I absolutely think that plays a part in it. But I think a larger part of it has to do with the utter disrespect, and I use that word very clearly. There's a great deal of disrespect in society, in culture, and in healthcare professions for sleep. One of the few places there isn't a disrespect is in the fields of psychiatry and psychology, where there's a lot of interest because people understand how important sleep is in its relationship to mental health. Yet, even there, they are narrowly constrained because the belief is, well, sleep is secondary to mental health. So obviously, if we just put somebody on this pill and it helps with their depression, then their sleep might get better. If their sleep doesn't get better, well, then maybe we should try Ambien. So they still have some narrowness as well in that regard. But I think the big issue here is that there is this tremendous ignorance or disrespect that, well, why would sleep be this important? How could it be this big a deal? I went to medical school. They never let me sleep there. I did residency. I slept even less there. So doctors learn this in a funny way, and they don't have a way to appreciate not only the importance of sleep, but I think it may be hard for them to appreciate how much their patients are suffering. People with insomnia suffer a great deal, and therefore I actually applaud the doctors who initially appreciate the patient needs a pill, because in the short term, that could be a good idea. That could actually help some people. But the problem is a lot of these people end up on the pills for months or years. And then it's never really working that well for most of these individuals.
Yeah, I actually know a couple people who take Ambien every night. And I was under the impression that's a really bad idea, that could have a long-term effect of actually making the insomnia worse. Is that right or not?
The several key points in what you said, because while there are some exceptions, like there's always going to be some patients who for whatever reasons, they themselves may have a personality style where, you know, they're not going to listen to any other discussion. Mm-hmm. And so the doctor and the patient have kind of got this contract, and the patient uses hopefully a lower dose of Ambien, and they may be on it for several years. That may be the best solution for that patient at that point in time, and it's not for us to sit here and judge them and say, no, you can't do it, because mm-hmm. for some people it may work. But the large majority of these people, it is my experience, especially people coming into a sleep center, they're not reporting they're getting this great response from Ambien or Lunesta or Trazodone or Remeron. They're often saying, I've gotten good responses from it at times, but not consistently and not using it every night. Furthermore, these individuals may not even know how to rate their response to the drug. Their primary care doctors or the other prescribing doctors may not know how to rate, you know, how they're doing with that drug. So what's happening is people are going with the lowest common denominator. And they're ending up with, well, you know, pretty much the only thing you can do is give somebody a pill, because there's not much else out there, and people aren't going to go into psychotherapy, or they're not going to do cognitive behavioral therapy, or whatever it happens to be. I mean, there's so many other options that you could consider. But of course, the last option would be, what do you mean? I have to go to a sleep center and get a sleep study, and then you're going to tell me I have to wear one of those crazy CPAP masks? I mean, those are very much non-starters for a lot of people. And sure. So I think a lot of healthcare providers are going to feel like their hands are tied, and they're going to go, I just have to prescribe the pill. I don't really see another option.
Well, people do come to your sleep center. How do they get there? Are they self-referred, or is it usually a doctor?
It can be both. Like in this particular study, we had about 10 or 15% self-referred. But, you know, about 60% came from primary doctors, and about 25% came from, you know, mental health providers. But they come for pretty much the same reason. They're not doing well.
Yeah.
So, but in their mind, when they're not doing well, one of the thoughts that they would have would be, so I'm not doing well with Ambien. Well, maybe I should talk to that doctor about Lunesta. Would somebody come and say, I've heard that there is cognitive behavioral therapy? Yes. Would there be somebody who come who would say, well, is there a way I can get off of this drug? So yes, we get people with a range of things of that sort, but they tend to not have a lot of that information handy. It's more coming out of, my doctor's getting frustrated still prescribing this drug. I'm not really clear how well this drug is working. I've always wondered if there might be some other options. I never got clear-cut information about what my other options were. So lots of different conversations occur. And what's so interesting for us in a sleep center is that unequivocally, between 80 to 90% of these individuals, once they have less than a 60, 30, or even 15-minute discussion about the possible link between a sleep breathing condition and insomnia, most of them become very interested, not because they're enthusiastic about wearing CPAP, but because they go, well, I've never heard of a theory like this, and I've always wondered why I have insomnia. And I've actually had this quote given to me hundreds of times of patients saying the phrase, well, that theory actually sounds more intelligent than any theory I've ever heard about insomnia. You know, and that's not to belittle in any way the cognitive behavioral theory, because that's also a very valid approach as well. But in other words, most of these patients had only heard the theory of, you can't sleep, we're going to give you a pill to knock you out, and that's how we're going to treat your insomnia. So that's why they thought talking about something like breathing sounded like, you know, much more sophisticated. And as they learn about it and they get their sleep studies, we show them the breathing events as they unfold on the sleep study. Now, the following morning we show this to them. And when they see it, they see they had a breathing event, and they see that they woke up. And they see that they woke up and they didn't go back to sleep. And we say to them, why do you think you didn't go back to sleep then? And I don't know, I'm going to just quiz you real quickly. Do you know what they might say, or do you know what you might say if you saw a breathing event and then you were up at night for several minutes, can you think of why you wouldn't have gone right back to sleep?
No, I don't know what I would say.
Well, here's what you need to think of. If you had a breathing event, you're actually engaged in a form of choking, which means that you're going to activate your sympathetic nervous system, your blood pressure, your pulse, your respiratory rate. All these things are going to accelerate, which is why so many people with insomnia wake up at night and they say the words, "This is really funny, doctor, but you know, when I wake up at night, I feel like I'm wide awake. Mm-hmm. I don't feel drowsy." And I say, yes, exactly. There's only a few things that can do that. One of them, of course, is a nightmare. But another one is if you have a breathing disorder, you're suffering from a mini suffocation that's leading up to the awakening. And then eventually your sympathetic nervous system takes over and you become wide awake. And that's not natural at all. You know, it's very natural to wake up a few times during the night, but then you wouldn't have activated the sympathetic nervous system. Instead, you'd wake up, you'd be drowsy, you'd roll over, you'd go right back to sleep. That's natural. That's normal.
Oh, okay. So not every awakening is unnatural then during the night.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's an interesting point.
Yeah. But these insomniacs, they don't appreciate that. And when you say to them, and they're staring at the computer monitor, and they're seeing the breathing event where they stop breathing, or they reduce their breathing, or their breathing was more shallow, and it led to this brain awakening, or what we call brain arousal. And we say to them, at this point, all of this other activity now is going to start going on with your brain. No wonder you're wide awake, and no wonder you're not relaxed enough to go back to sleep. As soon as they hear that, they think about, well, doc, if I could do something to make these breathing events go away, does that mean a lot of my insomnia would go away? And we say, well, that's what it appears to be. And there are research studies that have been published by our research team and Dr. Guimeneau's team at Stanford, where people are recognizing that if you treat these breathing events, you have a chance to produce a marked reduction in the insomnia severity.
Now, one of the things that you said in your article is that there's a widespread that insomnia is a psychological condition, a widespread belief. Who holds that belief, doctors or patients or both?
Well, the people who hold it the most would be pretty much everybody, in the sense that if you tell somebody you're not sleeping well, you know, in days of old, if you went to a doctor or a clergy person in, say, in the 19th century, the 18th century, the first question would be asked of you is, well, what's going on? You know, what's troubling you? And therefore, it is psychological. There is a component that's psychological. It's a very important component. The field of, behavioral sleep medicine is critical to the treatment of insomnia and, you know, developing new treatments and strategies, because no matter how good this impact is from the breathing, what you have to understand is that the individual who is susceptible to that awakening in the middle of the night and waking up and being anxious and being alert, that's also a feature of their psychology. Remember, the classic sleep apnea patient will wake up during the night hundreds of times. And even if they wake up and remember awakening 50 or 100 times, they're still going to roll over and go back to sleep. Why is that? Well, because they don't have the same response. They don't wake up and they're anxious or panicky or feeling, you know, overly alert. So the psychological aspect of insomnia is extremely relevant. It's extremely relevant to the patients who have the insomnia and the sleep disorder breathing, which is why we dubbed that disorder about 15 years ago with the term complex insomnia. And complex insomnia means that, you know, they have the added complexity of the sleep disordered breathing. But we're in no way suggesting that the psychological component shouldn't be addressed. The problem is that when most people hear psychological component, a lot of doctors and a lot of patients think that the prescription pad should be pulled out and that the pill should be written, and that's the end of the story. If you talk to, you know, a behavioral sleep medicine specialist, people like Jack Ettinger in Colorado and Jason Ong in Illinois, these are people who are actually developing some of their own theories and practices about how you treat the insomnia patient who has the sleep breathing problem and, of course, the psychophysiological insomnia. So that's, of course, what we did in our book, Sound Sleep, Sound Mind, where we talk about sleep dynamic therapy. We offer that same, you know, co-occurring treatments. We don't like sequential treatment for these patients. We like, you know, for there to be co-occurring treatment where you get your sleep breathing treatment, you get your cognitive behavioral therapy, you do them at the same time, because then you get better faster. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Ettinger in Denver and Dr. Ong in Chicago, they're working on some clinics very similar, as well as to some of their own unique variations on these themes of, well, how do you really treat somebody who's got complex insomnia, meaning, you know, both conditions?
Mm-hmm. One of the things you point out is that many or most people don't realize that they're experiencing breathing disturbances during sleep. Why is it that they don't, on their own, sort of make that connection?
Well, I mean, the simplest answer is, what are they doing while they're sleeping? They're sleeping. So the chances of being able to be aware of it mm-hmm. become higher if you wake up choking and you stop breathing and you wake up in a panic and you go, hey, you know, something's going on here. Obviously, if you have a bed partner who says the same thing. This is why, and I'm glad you brought this up, because in terms of symptoms, it turns out that insomnia symptoms with sleep breathing problems appear to have about the same amount of breathing symptoms as classic sleep apnea patients. But as we said earlier, you know, that this is just an ignored thing. So what we tend to look at is not the breathing symptoms in these insomnia patients, because they don't readily make that connection for what we've been, for the reasons we've been talking about. Instead, we'll look at other symptoms. So, for example, most people don't understand or have not heard, including most primary care doctors have not, you know, been trained to know that if you have sleep apnea, there's an excellent chance that will cause you to wake up at night to urinate. And I'll explain these in a moment, but there's also an excellent chance you'll wake up in the morning with a dry mouth, or you'll wake up in the morning with a headache. Now, notice those three symptoms. One's called trips to the bathroom or nocturia. One's called, xerostomia, dry mouth in the morning. And the other would be called cephalalgia, a morning headache. Each one of these three symptoms occurs while you are awake. Therefore, if you actually only use those three symptoms and you spoke to your insomnia patients, of which many of them have these problems, they would then be able to make the connection, because they would have awareness of what's going on with them while they're awake, as opposed to trying to pin them down saying, well, do you snore? Do you choke or gasp in your sleep? Do you stop breathing? Do you see the difference?
Yeah. Now, what about age in here? Because I know that guys, particularly as they get older and their prostates get larger, I guess, seem to wake up a lot during the night to go to the bathroom. Does that necessarily mean that they're suffering from a breathing problem, or could it be more of a bladder problem? We tend to think it's a bladder problem. I'll speak for myself.
Right, absolutely. As you get older, a number of things happen with aging, including your sleep breathing disorder can get worse. And of course, bladder problems, prostate problems, problems with dehydration, wanting to drink more water, and so forth. All those things can happen. But I can tell you two things. One, with respect to patients that we've seen at our center, and I corroborated this with, you know, other centers around the country, When you have a prostate problem, that actually doesn't seem to be as much a cause of the nocturia as it does to be a cause of other kinds of daytime problems. And in fact, the patients who come here with prostatism, we still find that their trips to the bathroom decrease once they use PAP therapy and treat their sleep disordered breathing. Now, the connection to this, this is the second thing, which is a little bit tricky, and I've actually got another website that the viewers can look at. It's called nocturiacures.com. That's nocturiacures.com. And on that website, I have a 5-minute video, and I'll run through it here in less than 60 seconds. Basically, when you're struggling to breathe during the night, you create all this pressure in your chest cavity, which then pushes on the blood supply returning to the heart. So when the venous system inside the chest cavity is being pressured, so to speak, by all of this extra pressure when you try to breathe, the blood flow of the venous system rushes blood faster back into the right atrium of the heart, and the right atrium of the heart perceives the process as fluid overload. This happens to be a false fluid overload signal, but that doesn't matter. The point is that the right atrium is getting too much fluid too fast, and it has to respond. And so what happens is the right atrium of the heart releases the body's natural diuretic, known as ANP, and that diuretic goes to the kidneys, and people make more urine then during the night, and therefore they get up and have more trips to the bathroom. When somebody uses a PAP machine, that whole cycle is reversed, and they stop going to the bathroom at night.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And actually, you have a great animation about that in that video, YouTube video that I'm putting the link to on our site, so people will be able to see it there. And it was a great video animation that I wanted to talk about. So I'm glad that you went there.
Right. We'd be at both places. I forgot. We have it in the video for the Mayo Clinic and then on our own website, Nocturia Cures. So, yes, in both cases, one's animated and one is a whiteboard talk that I gave to some occupational health nurses.
I have to say you are extremely productive, because when I went to YouTube to look at this particular research, I saw a whole raft of YouTube videos that I guess are in connection with your, you know, with where you work, and there's a continual outreach to the public to inform people.
Absolutely, and of course you've just given me the perfect opportunity to explain why I have so much energy to be so productive, and the answer is that I use PAP therapy every night. I've been on it since 2002, so this is about my 13th year or so, and I use one of these very advanced devices that we mentioned in the video. It's called adaptive servo-ventilation, and that particular device is one that we particularly find to be useful in mental health patients and insomnia patients, because the standard CPAP device can be very anxiety producing for a lot of patients because it only works with one set pressure. These newer devices, the one that I'm on, allows for dual pressures when you breathe in and when you breathe out. It also has a computer chip that measures your breathing, so it's adjusting the pressures all during the night. And we just published a poster this summer at the American Academy of Sleep Medicine Conference where we showed that when insomnia patients use these more advanced devices, they will generally get at least a 50% reduction in insomnia just by using the device.
Wow. Now, is this a question of old technology versus new technology, and will the old technology sort of be phased out, do you think, and the new one take over?
That's a great question, because in the world of quote-unquote everyday sleep medicine, most people prescribe CPAP devices. Whereas if you look at our sleep center, we have not prescribed a CPAP device in a decade because we specialize in the treatment of mental health patients with sleep disorders. So very quickly, we had to figure out why were these people struggling so much with CPAP. And so we first switched to a device called Bilevel, which is a dual pressure device, meaning when you breathe in, you get a high pressure because it's so comfortable. But when you breathe out, the machine drops to a lower pressure to make it easier for you to breathe out. These other devices that I'm talking about, auto bilevel, ASV, ASV stands for adaptive servo ventilation. All of those kinds of devices have the bilevel, but they have more with the computer algorithm in it to constantly adjust the pressures throughout the night. So I actually...
In other words, they're customized to the person?
Absolutely, absolutely. Mm-hmm. We still bring the patient into the sleep lab to work with it because the algorithm is not perfect, but it still is better than the CPAP device.
Mm-hmm.
And so in answer to your question, it's gotten to the point where I actually have written editorials that have been published in a journal like the Journal of Clinical Sleep Medicine and other places describing why we do it this way. And then other people will write back counterpoints to what we say, and they'll say, well, there's no proof of that. And so they're correct. I mean, there is, you know, we're actually finishing up a paper right now that we're hoping to submit for publication before the end of the year, showing that many people really can be moved over to these more advanced devices when they drop out of care because they couldn't handle CPAP. You know, the rate of CPAP use is fairly low. I mean, many people report that maybe 30, 40, 50, or 60% of people use the device. At our center, on a regular basis, about once a year, every 2 years, we do a little run-through of 100 consecutive patients to check what the use rate is amongst our sample. And I can tell you that for people who take the step of going through their testing and filling the prescription, meaning they actually got their machine, our rate over the last 5 years has been between 88 and 91% are still using the device. And we attribute that not just to the fact that we may have special techniques we use at our center, but we also believe the technology with these ASV and auto bilevel devices has made a tremendous difference in the way we can objectively improve their sleep and therefore their comfort using the machine.
Now, is there a big cost differential between the CPAP and the newer devices? And if so, are these devices available for rent, or are they covered at all by insurance? Tell us about the cost factor.
Right. There was, a few years ago, huge cost differences. Now the cost differences are less. For example, if you wanted to buy, you know, without using your insurance, and by the way, all these devices I'm describing can all be covered by insurance, but some of them you have to jump through more hoops to make the insurance company comfortable that you quote unquote qualify for that device because they have certain criteria, you know, that you have to use. But all these devices are also sold at various locations. For example, I work with a durable medical equipment company out of California called Classic Sleep Care. And if a person wanted to get a device through them, they could contact them. There's also another website-oriented company, Classic Sleep Care is a large company in California and Las Vegas. The other company is called, SecondWindCPAP.com, something like that. And you can get, you know, different prices that way. But anybody who goes to a sleep center who has health insurance will usually have what's called durable medical equipment coverage. And so once you get diagnosed with sleep apnea, you're going to be covered for a PAP device. Where it gets tricky is that if you use the device and you're not getting a good response, then if your sleep facility is not willing to listen to the discussion like we're having here today, they might say, well, just keep using the CPAP and like a year from now, you'll get used to it. Mm-hmm. And our experience is, and particularly with mental health patients, that doesn't happen. After a week, a couple weeks, maybe a month, most people like turn the machine in or put it in their closet and just ignore it because they can't really use CPAP. Again, CPAP is fixed pressure only. It doesn't really acclimate, you know, to the patient's breathing, yeah. So to speak.
Yeah. You know, one thing that kind of surprised me is in your paper, you in the conclusions area, you say, and I quote, although the relationship between insomnia and sleep disorder breathing remains undefined, and I went, really? This isn't known? I mean, in a way, that seems to contradict what you've been saying. It sounds like you in fact, know a lot about it.
Well, I think I know a lot about it, but when we talk about scientific knowledge and what's in the scientific literature, we have to be reasonable to say, you know, what has been proven. Mm-hmm. And if you say what has been proven about the relationship between sleep apnea and insomnia, you actually have to step back and say that we don't really know how many patients with insomnia have a type of sleep disordered breathing that is actually influencing their insomnia. So that's not really in the scientific literature yet.
That's very surprising.
No, it's actually not. If you think about the silo effect, think about how insomnia researchers over the last several decades would be neuroscientists, psychologists, people who are not really that interested in breathing. And if you think about who's doing all the clinical care of sleep apnea in the United States in particular, it's largely going to be internists and pulmonologists. So if those groups are in their individual silos, why would they be communicating with each other about the relationship between insomnia and sleep disordered breathing? And I've actually written papers on this point and even an op-ed some years ago about how these groups are going to have to come out of their silos and begin to work together, because there are so many patients who have this comorbidity. But it really just depends on what sleep center you went to. If you go to a sleep center that's run only by pulmonologists who've had no training in behavioral sleep medicine, only give pills to insomnia patients, and don't really read the scientific literature, they're going to be seeing lots of insomnia patients who have sleep disordered breathing, and all they're going to get is a pill. So in some of those cases, it might work, but a lot of them probably won't be getting state-of-the-art care. The same thing if somebody, you know, goes into a mental health clinic and the individuals are practicing, you know, very first-rate evidence-based cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, they're going to get good results, but the results are also going to be diminished by the fact that they're going to miss the comorbidity of sleep disordered breathing in that patient. And then the question then becomes, well, what does that all mean when people are missing these things? And that's why you have to make a statement like that in the paper, because there is a lot unknown about this in terms of what's in the scientific literature. Yet if you were to ask me the question, how many of my patients presenting with insomnia are actually having the factor of sleep disordered breathing contributing to the insomnia? I can tell you, you know, clinically, anecdotally, the number is over 80%. I can tell you that I've worked with some amazing patients at my center who've had the worst, most horrible psychological insomnia on multiple medications. And I realize from my work that people who are in dire straits like that for their insomnia, they often have very severe sleep apnea. So some of these patients, I've had to work very hard to help them get on PAP therapy, use PAP therapy regularly. And now these are insomniacs who will not sleep without a PAP device. At the same time, we also had to work on the psychological aspects of their insomnia. So both factors were incredibly important, but I'm convinced that they never could have achieved the kind of responses they're achieving now had they not also used the PAP device.
Uh-huh. Well, that's really fascinating. Now, how widely distributed are sleep centers? Is this something that's in only the very largest cities in the country, or, you know, how big does a city have to be likely, or maybe you know the total number for the nation?
There are several thousand.
Okay.
And so they're pretty much all over now. I mean, there's always going to be a small community that may not have a sleep center, but yet, even if it's a small community, as long as it's within, 30 or 50 miles of another larger city nowadays, I mean, even in New Mexico, there's at least, I'm going to say 10 different cities in New Mexico, and it might be even higher than that. And we don't have a lot of large cities, in New Mexico. So a lot of people can find access. One of the problems, though, that's occurring in transition in our field is that nowadays, many of the insurance companies are trying to push this idea of what's called portable testing. And portable testing is a good tool when you're dealing with classic and severe sleep apnea patients because it's really easy to diagnose them. Many insomnia patients, though, that we've been talking about may not have very severe sleep apnea. They may have mild to moderate, and yet it's still important in trying to treat their insomnia. So those people, if they underwent one of these home portable tests, somebody might look at that test and go, okay, well, that's just mild. We'll just tell that person, don't bother with this. And that's happening all across the country now. That was happening before because some people didn't take mild to moderate sleep apnea very seriously. But regardless, now it's happening because the insurance companies are preventing some sleep centers from doing any kind of sleep tests. They're making it so you can only send out these portable devices for home testing. In fact, back east, several sleep centers affiliated with Harvard just a few years ago were shut down because the insurance company they were dealing with refused to let them run their practice the way they wanted to, and they switched practice to somebody who was doing all these home tests in the belief they were going to save lots of money, have the insurance company make lots of money. But when they did this, they didn't realize that if you don't treat people for sleep apnea, you actually lose more money than what you would have saved.
So what's the difference between the testing that would be done with the portable machine versus what you would do in your clinic?
Generally speaking, the problem is that you've got the logistics of, is the patient going to put the sensors on correctly? Is it going to all go, very simplistically so you're going to get good data? And then the other thing is that most of the devices don't even measure all the breathing events. Or if they do measure them, they don't make the calculation readily available for the doctor to review to make a more informed decision. There are basically three types of breathing events. One is the classic apnea where you stop breathing. One is the hypopnea, which is about a 50% reduction. Well, a lot of these home tests only score those two breathing events because they make the mistake of believing those are the only two serious kinds of breathing events. There's another kind of breathing event that's about a 20 to 30% reduction in breathing, and yet it still causes that sleep fragmentation that we talked about at the beginning of the hour. So if you don't have a study that can measure that, then all these people will get home tests and they will be getting the wrong diagnosis or the severity level will be off. In the sleep lab, obviously, we've been doing this for decades, and most sleep labs can conduct very high-quality sleep studies and get good information. Remarkably, many of the home tests have to be repeated because they weren't even done correctly the first time, And that's not true for every single home testing device, but it appears to be true for a fair number of them.
So what is it that you monitor, either with the home testing or in your clinic? Is it, you know, are you wearing a mask that's monitoring airflow, or are there EEG sensors as well? Or, you know, what is being measured?
Exactly right. So in the home testing, all you really measure is basically the heart rate and a breathing sensor that looks like an oxygen cannula. You may have some straps around your chest and abdomen to measure your breathing effort. You know, there's not a lot, and you definitely don't measure sleep, which means you don't actually know whether the person was asleep or not. Mm. You can't prove it. You have to have some kind of sensor that, you know, guesstimates it so that you can try to score the test correctly. But now here again, you're missing out on all this aspect of sleep fragmentation, and therefore you don't really know what's happening. Obviously, you get all those sensors and more, including the EEG and the limb movements and all these other things that can tell us fully what is going on during the night.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I'm not saying the home test can't serve a purpose for the classic apnea patients and the people who have really grossly severe sleep apnea as a first step. But then what they're also doing is telling these people to just go out and try using PAP therapy without ever coming into the lab again. And we just don't find that's very effective. We see thousands of patients seeking second opinions at our center because they're dissatisfied with their initial attempts. And nowadays, a lot of those initial attempts were with those home tests.
So I'm asking about people who sleep alone and therefore may not know the extent to which they're snoring, choking, gasping, et cetera. And I'm aware that there are these alternative devices for monitoring sleep quality. For example, Apple iPhone 6 has a health monitoring that will interface with a number of apps and devices such as wristbands and such. Are these presently or in the future likely to be good enough for self-diagnostic purposes?
Probably not. They're going to be very good for the description of whether or not you've got good sleep quality or bad sleep quality. In that realm, they have a very useful purpose. For example, there's another one out there, the Zio head monitor, and there's other kinds of tracking devices. All these things are very useful right now. If, for example, I've had some patients use the Zio and they've come back and said to me, you know, it looks like I'm not getting a lot of REM sleep. I said, exactly. You've just proven to yourself that there's some pathophysiological disturbance to your sleep. And that just was what the Zio showed you. And that you're going to therefore now need to come in and get a full night's sleep study and go forward. Now, ultimately, will we all have our Dr. McCoy tricorder system that would allow us to actually diagnose sleep apnea or leg jerks in our own bed? Unequivocally, that will happen. But right now, the use of these tools is more about showing the problem of sleep fragmentation, poor sleep quality, but not the diagnosis of the disorder causing it.
Yeah, but they could be a good first step to kind of prove to a person that, yes, I do have disordered sleep.
Excellent first step.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Are there any dietary recommendations for those with insomnia? For example, last night when I had trouble getting to sleep, I had a cup of warm milk.
Did it help?
I think it did.
Right.
But I also got up and I watched TV for a while and had my cup of warm milk and, you know, had initially tried to go to bed at 11 and just felt very frustrated. I could just tell the sleep wasn't coming. So I got up and then went back to bed at 1 with pretty good success.
Right. Well, you actually practice perfect stimulus control technique of cognitive behavioral therapy. The thing that was most important was you recognize you weren't going to sleep. instead of letting yourself get too frustrated, you got up, you did something either enjoyable, satisfying. I don't know what you watched on TV. Maybe it was a documentary and so it was productive. Maybe it was a sitcom and it made you laugh. But the point is, after that period of doing that, you kind of had taken your mind off of your sleep, which allowed your sleepiness to return to you. And of course, whether a glass of, you know, warm milk is a placebo or not, doesn't matter. It plays into the concept of, hey, I'm not really worried about my sleep right now. I'm going to watch TV. I'm going to have a nice glass of warm milk. And next thing you know, you get sleepy again. You go back to bed and you fall asleep. So, I mean, there's all sorts of things people point to and say, like, you know, turkey sandwiches and what have you. But it's more about not eating foods that will cause indigestion that is good for somebody who's an insomnia.
Right.
That's probably the most important factor.
Yeah. And boy, I sure know what you're talking about, and maybe I learned this from you from our last interview. I'm not sure to just get up and not go into that anxiety laden state of worrying about the fact that, oh my God, I can't get to sleep. I can't get to sleep. And it's true. You can really work up quite a head of steam if you allow yourself to go down that rabbit hole.
Yeah, and let me expand on that in a certain way and bring it back to breathing, because this is something that we wrote about in the book in 2007, the Sound Sleep book, and we call it the Respiratory Threat Matrix Model of Chronic Insomnia. I'm of the opinion, and this is a very, very difficult thing to prove, even though once I've explained it to many of my patients, they've also commented that it seems to make some sense, and that is that I believe that insomnia patients, many of them have these breathing problems such that when they're in bed, there is always something in the back of their mind, their subconscious, whatever you want to call it, that knows that they may not breathe well. Because in fact, if you do have a sleep breathing disorder and you have insomnia, there's a good chance you've been having that for years, if not decades. And so if that is in the back of your mind, I like to point out, what's the easiest way to prevent yourself from getting into bed, falling asleep, and start choking? And of course, the answer is have insomnia. And what's the fastest way to have insomnia? And the answer is develop racing thoughts when you get into bed. And so I had actually tested this theory, just an N of one experiment. But when I first discovered this relationship for myself, it was 1998, and I had just been exposed to using a dental device for the treatment of my sleep disordered breathing, even though, ironically, my main complaint was insomnia. I clearly had psychophysiological insomnia. I clearly had racing thoughts, but a dentist friend of mine suggested that I try a dental device. Well, I tried it and I noticed that it was very helpful. I noticed I was having much less insomnia. But the part that was so peculiar was that I noticed I had less racing thoughts when I would get into bed and try to go to sleep. So my experiment was I got my tax returns and I brought them to bed with me. And I began reading through all of my taxes and finances and worrying about all of my financial situations in my life, trying to make myself really anxious. And then I put that aside. I put my dental device on. And as I put my dental device on, I was thinking about all of my worries, but it didn't work. I went right to sleep.
What sort of dental device?
It's something that holds your jaw thrusted slightly forward.
Okay.
And now your airway is larger in the back of your throat.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
So we've repeated that discussion with other patients, and we've been surprised how many patients, even though we do believe there's a psychological component to insomnia, we've been impressed with how many patients will tell us, oh, well, no, when I put that PAP machine on, that helps me get really sleepy, and I go right to sleep. I don't have any more racing thoughts.
You know, I mentioned earlier the iPhone, and you talked about some of the things that can be hooked up to that. Is there anything that would click on to record your snoring, you know, a kind of time delay thing that would be triggered by the sound of snoring? Do you know if there's an app like that out there?
Years ago, when I first got into the field of sleep medicine, I was doing dream research. So I did voice-activated memory because, you know, it's much better, as you know, to try to recall your dreams literally the second that you wake up.
Yes.
I'm assuming that there's some degree of voice activation of that can be used in that way, like you're saying, where it may record loud enough breathing events. I have not seen the device, but in today's world of technology, I'd be surprised there isn't something out there like that.
Yeah. Now, one perennial question seems to be, how many hours of sleep do we really need per night? And, you know, it seems like that number moves around a bit. What's the latest what does the latest research reveal?
That's a great question to end on, because the real answer is that it's unknown. We've treated these patients, you know, over the last decade in particular, we've always been saying to them, there's no way possible for us to know what your number of hours should be, because you're not sleeping normally yet. You know, you have all this sleep fragmentation, these breathing problems, these leg movement problems. You have nightmares. You have insomnia. How could anybody possibly be able to inform you how much sleep you really need? And so what happens is the people begin to realize that they're going to take their sleep quality a lot more seriously than they're going to take their sleep quantity. And the reason that's so important is that if you obsess about sleep quantity, you're going to end up with more insomnia. So in this discussion of the sleep quality, people begin to move down a different pathway. And we've seen things all over the map in terms of numbers. I can tell you in my own experience that I was averaging about 8.5 hours a night of actual sleep ever since I left medical school and residency in 1986 up to about a decade later, 1996. But then when I started treating my sleep-disordered breathing, the number of hours that I needed to sleep, which seemed like, you know, not waking up with an alarm clock, feeling rested the next day and so forth, that began dropping consistently to 7.5 or less. And now my average amount of sleep ranges between 6.5 and 7.5. It doesn't mean there aren't times where I might not sleep, you know, 8 hours and 8 hours a night for a week. And there's also times where I might sleep 6 hours every night for a week. And yet I might feel almost the same. So what we say to people is, first of all, stop obsessing about quantity, because that's going to make your insomnia worse. Focus on the quality. And then once you have ramped up the quality, then you're going to discover what are the range of hours you tend to sleep. I'm not at all discounting the fact that some people should go on regular schedule. Some people like that. They do better with it. I happen to be one of those people because I run a sleep lab. I can't have the most regular schedule that I might desire. And so my number of hours might vary from night to night or week to week. But I still sleep on the basis not of an alarm clock, but I wake up when my sleep is finished.
Yeah, I do that too. Fortunately, I'm retired, and so I can afford to do that. But also, I always had an internal clock that I could pretty much count on almost to the minute. It's kind of amazing that someplace deep in my brain, somebody's counting the seconds practically. There's another thing I wanted to touch on before we go, which is just by coincidence, yesterday I saw a TED.com presentation by Jeff Liff titled "One More Reason to Get a Good Night's Sleep." And he describes research that he and a team did showing that the way the brain gets rid of its waste is by dumping it into the cerebral spinal fluid. and that this waste disposal process is greatly accelerated during sleep. So no wonder we feel bad if we don't get enough sleep.
Oh, absolutely. And that's just common sense. I mean, it's true that it's great that we're finally getting that research out there. And it's great that, you know, they have, you know, done the TED Talk and all that. And hopefully more of that is coming down the pike. But anybody who's a human has figured this out already, that obviously you sleep to regenerate yourself. That regeneration is making you have more energy. It makes you look refreshed. Yep. And one of the most important things people need to hear about, which sometimes motivates them, is that, you know, when a person treats sleep apnea and when they go on the PAP device, it is very common that their friends and family members will say, hey, what have you been doing? You look a lot younger. And that's because when you treat sleep apnea, you are either reversing or you are slowing down the aging process. And that's a very big deal.
Okay, well, maybe by way of wrapping up, let me ask you, what are the implications of your research and your clinical experience for clinical psychologists and other therapists with clients who complain about insomnia?
Yeah, I think the main point is we go back to what we've all learned as healthcare providers. There's a differential diagnosis, and the differential diagnosis for insomnia is a lot broader than we may have previously been trained to believe. And therefore, we need to step back when we're about to write a prescription, or we need to step back when we think it's only, you know, in their mind. We need to step back and say, what else could we do? And the answer is often going to be that the person needs an evaluation at a sleep center or by a sleep specialist or at some clinic that, you know, works with sleep professionals to find out if there's something physiologically that is going on in the sleep itself that is a part of the insomnia. And if that's the case, then that individual, I would say, needs to defer the use of the sleeping pills, unless we're talking about the serious cases of patients with suicidal ideation or other types of distress, where the pill then becomes very appropriate. But I would say that most of these patients do not fit that category. Most patients have bad insomnia. They've had it for a while. Now it's time to apply the differential diagnosis and see how else we can help them to get a better response, which I think they will get once they're exposed to learning about the underlying sleep disorder breathing problem and learning about treatment options for sleep disordered breathing.
Okay, well, that's wonderful advice. And Dr. Barry Krakow, I want to thank you for being my guest again today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, David.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Dr. Barry Krakow and got some useful tips if you suffer at all from insomnia. If you do suffer from insomnia, I definitely recommend his 2007 book, Sound Sleep, Sound Mind. Also, you can find information about his upcoming workshops on his websites, which include www.sleeptreatment.com and www.nightmaretreatment.com. I also interviewed Dr. Krakow on his approach to treating PTSD on my other podcast series some years ago on Wise Counsel at wisecounselpodcast.com. You'll find that if you look through the archives there. I think the biggest takeaway for me from our conversation today is both the prevalence of obstructed breathing among insomniacs, especially for those whom drug therapy has not provided sufficient relief, and also the fact that there is, as of yet, no hard scientific evidence to support the extensive clinical experience of Dr. Krakow and other sleep clinicians. Personally, I'm impressed by the data he's gathered over the years, and I'm also impressed that this is backed up by his own personal experience of having been on an assisted breathing device for many years. This is a personal glimpse that I don't recall him sharing in our previous two interviews. I don't often suffer from insomnia, but I'm still curious enough to want to see what's out there that could be paired with my iPhone 6 to give me an overview of my sleep. Who knows where that might lead? If it leads someplace especially interesting, I'll be sure to let you know. Another takeaway for me is that there's no simple one-size-fits-all solution. Psychotherapists need to be aware that differential diagnosis is critical and that the most effective intervention may be a combination of psychotherapy plus the use of an assisted breathing device rather than either or. That was another piece of new learning for me, that there is the older CPAP approach alongside the newer variable airflow devices containing computerized algorithms. It will be interesting to see what the future brings by way of new technologies and treatment designs. By the way, I highly recommend that TED.com presentation I mentioned. Look for one titled, One More Reason to Get a Good Night's Sleep, by Jeff Liff, and Liff is spelled L-L-I-F-F. I think it gives us a peek at some exciting new insight into the brain's function, including possible implications for research on Alzheimer's.
Hello, fellow Shrink Wrappers. I have a couple of questions for you. Do you think that Dave is doing a good job? Well, I do anyway. And do you wish for him to continue producing these podcasts? I sure do. So, are you willing to support him? I just did. It's easy. Go to the Shrink Wrap Radio website. Click Support on the top menu. Select the amount you wish to contribute. If you have a PayPal account, enter your credentials. If you don't have a PayPal account, you can still do one-time donations by just entering your credit card details. PayPal will take care of the rest, David will be happy, and we will all get the benefit of his excellent guests and his well-honed interview skills. Now to my last question. When will you do it?
Thank you for that reminder, Sven. You all may recall that it was Sven who finally helped me to decide not to put all this content behind a paywall. So you can answer Sven's question, if not now, when? By going ahead and becoming a financial contributor now. In that vein, I'd like to thank the two donors who have stepped up since the last podcast. First of all, thanks to Manuel Lopez and also to Joan Kelly. Your support means so much to me. Once again, let me announce our new holistic and nutritional approaches to treating psychological disorders for 5 CEUs. It's been a while since I put up a new course. It's available through the fully accredited Zur Institute. You can find a link to it on our website under the Store tab. It's reasonably priced at less than $10 per unit. And by the way, you don't have to be a professional to purchase the course. Anyone can do it and use it to beef up your resume or just for your own personal satisfaction. Also, I've started posting video clips on YouTube announcing the current show, and you can check these out on my new YouTube channel, which you'll find at www.youtube.com/user/shrinkwrapradio and the numeral 1, and that's all one word. Please remember to patronize our authors who advertise on our site in the right-hand sidebar. The latest is John C. Robinson, and clicking on the link will take you to all his books on his website. And then there's Amazon.com. You know there is also an Amazon widget in the right-hand sidebar that you can use to order any books you wish, but not only books, but anything at Amazon. I know many of you probably use Amazon regularly to purchase all sorts of things. And if you'll use the search tool in our widget, it will automatically add our affiliate code, and Shrink Wrap will get a small percentage of the purchase. It's a great way that you can help to support us, and it's perfect for the holiday season. I am afraid there's no new transcript to announce today. About 3/4 of our interviews have been transcribed by listeners such as yourself. You can take a look at the transcripts page on our site where all the transcripts and progress are listed. Episodes that you don't see there need to be transcribed. Doing a transcript is another way you can support Shrink Wrap Radio. And people who've done it tell me it's very rewarding because as they re-listen, they get the content at a much deeper level. Drop me an email if you'd like to take one on. The Audible.com audiobook I'm listening to right now is another mystery by the noted Danish author Joe Nesbø. The title is Phantom. I've read/listened to almost all his books on Audible, and I'll feel so sad when I come to the end. I sure hope he continues to turn these out. So if you'd like to listen along with me and you're not already an Audible.com subscriber, you can get this audiobook for free and to keep with no obligation to continue your subscription by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. And of course, you don't have to get Phantom by Joe Nesbø. They have 165 other titles for you to choose from. And finally, if you're new to Shrink Wrap Radio, you might not be aware that we have an app for that. That is for listening to these shows and communicating with me. And you can find full details on our site under the Apps tab.
Hi, this is journalist Jamal Yogis, author of The Fear Project, here on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, journalist Jamal Yogis. Our conversation on The Fear Project stands out as one of the most energizing yet. Now let's take a quick dip into the old email bag, and I'll read just one. This one from Andrew, who writes, Dr. Dave, thank you very much for the prompt and timely email. It's wonderful that you take time to send personal responses to your listener community, and I'm deeply moved by that. Thank you again for all that you do regarding bringing a richer and more holistic understanding to the field of psychology, which validates many of my thoughts and understanding of the field of psychology in general and psychotherapy in particular. It's nice to hear so many other like-minded professionals out there and that the field really isn't completely moving towards band-aid-focused psychotherapy and production-based widget psychology. In parentheses, he says, my snarkiness shining through on that, ha! Huh? Close quote. He goes on to say, these are the general impressions I'm receiving in my training, but enough on that. Thank you for the advice regarding acquiring episodes of your podcast. Now I'm not worried about running out of episodes and having to wait for one each week yet. And thank you for directing me to the Wise Counsel podcast as well. I'm excited to listen to those as well. I must say, I am moved by your podcast as well as your personalized email, and I think I can shift some stuff around and get off my butt and make that contribution right now. It's not much compared to what you've given both myself and others. Thank you for all that you do. Respectfully, Andrew. And Andrew, thank you so much for getting off your bottom, I will say, and making that contribution. I really appreciate it, and I really appreciate that the show really hits the right chord for you. So I think with that, we better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to Dr. Barry Krakow for sharing his research as well as his clinical knowledge of insomnia. My next guest will be UK-based counselor Simon Cole, who will be discussing his new book, Stillness in Mind, which describes his use of mindfulness in his work. So I do hope you will join us for that. And until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind. We'll be right back.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.